Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The last act makes a film. Wow them in the end, you got a hit. You can have flaws, problems, but wow them in the end, and you've got a hit. Your characters must change, and the change must come from them.
If you've seen the Spike Jonze movie Adaptation, you probably remember that scene. It features Nicolas Cage and Brian Cox. Cox is playing the preeminent story authority, Robert McKee. Robert McKee is based on the real Robert McKee. He's one of the world's most popular authors and lecturers on the art of story. The list of people who have attended his seminars include over 70 Academy Award winners and 250 Emmy Award winners. Now Robert is back to talk about characters. Did you ever wonder why Tony Soprano, Don Draper, Walter White, Beth Harmon, and even Larry David are so magnetic? Robert knows why, and he analyzes it in his book, Character, The Art of Role and Cast Design for Page, Stage, and Screen. We caught up with Robert to talk about why characters are becoming more complicated, what it was like to see himself adapted to the screen, and to find out what is more important, story or character. Or as it is better known as, the Aristotle debate.
And the Aristotle debate is what is more important as in writing, the story you tell or the characters in the story. Aristotle said story, and the character was second to that. And then over the centuries, it got reversed, and people said, no, what people really want are wonderfully complex, fascinating, memorable characters, and the story is just a clothesline to hang them on. And on it goes. The truth is that it's a ridiculous question to begin with. Mm-hmm. You can't ask the question, what's more important, story or character, because they are the same thing. They're just two sides of the same coin. They cannot be artificially separated, as I do in my books, in the writing, because a story is a sequence of events, right? And an event is a choice that some character or characters make to take an action and cause reactions in their life and their world. And as they choose to act, they are dramatized as human beings. Who are these people? The kind of people who would make those choices and take those actions under those circumstances. That's who they are. But people like to argue.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. So what do you want your readers to learn from reading Character?
Complexity. Today, especially, and into the rest of this century and beyond, the demand on writers will be to explore human nature in greater depths and greater complexities than ever. And one of the reasons that that demand is being made is because writers are now given more time than ever to tell their story. If you wrote a play for hundreds of years, you had something like 2-3 hours, or if it's Hamlet, 4 hours, but generally 2 hours to dramatize characters. 2 hours isn't very much. Long-form television now is virtually unlimited. So instead of 2 hours, you now have 80 hours. Instead of a cast of 6 characters, you now have casts of 60 characters. And what holds people to watching over long periods of time like that are two things. Revelations of character, discovering season after season aspects of the character you've never seen before, taking them into more complexity, and change. In a long-form television, a three-dimensional character is at best a supporting role. Characters like Walter White are 16-dimensional. Tony Soprano is 12-dimensional.
Forget about the way that Tony Soprano makes his way in the world. That's just to feed his children. There's 2 Tony Sopranos. You've never seen the other one. That's the one I want to show to you.
So that's why I wrote the book. For everyone, no matter what medium they want to write in, to create more complex, but true, of course, not just gimmicky, but truly deep characters and to open themselves up as writers to the dark side of human nature, mm-hmm. because that's where the complexity will come from.
Yeah. You draw on Matthew Weiner's groundbreaking TV series Mad Men to illustrate how these various selves are used to flesh out the lead characters of the series. Can you kind of walk us through how these apply to John Hamm's character, Don Draper?
Yeah, well, I also, they had a system, you know, sitting, you know, 10 writers sitting around a room. When discussing the characters, that somebody would say, well, that's, you know, that's their personal self, but when they're in public, they behave. And then I added to that the subconscious self that they may have thought about, but they didn't actually talk about in their discussions of how they wrote it. And Don Draper's secret was that he stole his identity from a dead lieutenant during the Korean War in order to escape the war. His subconscious self, does he find life meaningless? He's a very successful ad executive, a star at the agency. He's got a beautiful wife, children, the whole perfect package, and he finds the whole thing pointless.
I'm not the man you think I am. I broke all my vows. Scandalized my child. Took another man's name and made nothing of it.
And so the whole series is about Don Draper's brilliant public success, his failed marriage and family, his personal disasters. But what's driving it is a quest for meaning, for finding purpose in life. And by the very end of the series, he does actually, I believe, find his meaning when he comes to realize that being a superb ad executive is meaningful. He's really, really good at it. And for a human being to be able to do at least one thing really, really well that makes a difference in the world, adds to the lives of other people, is a good thing, is a meaningful thing. And so he's a wonderful character.
Oh, definitely. And very complex and very dimensional. In a section about true character and free will, you reference an iconic scene from the great British sitcom, Fawlty Towers, which was created by John Cleese and Connie Booth. Can you tell us about this scene and how it connects with your thoughts about character and free will?
Comic characters, what makes a character a comic character is that they have a desire, something that they want, extremely that they want, but they are blind to it. It's what we call a blind obsession. So, for example, Larry David, the great Larry David, in Curb Your Enthusiasm, has an obsession with propriety. He believes there's a certain way to behave in public that other people just don't seem to get.
I don't quite get your point. All right, well, the man, I'm going to tell you my point. I've got a sneaking suspicion that you're predicting rain to clear the golf course for yourself.
Oh, my God. That's ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
It's happened before,
weatherman. You know it. And you know what? I'm calling the weather people.
You're going to say, report me because it's a nice day?
I'm going to report you because every time you want to play golf,
Larry,
you make sure that it's raining.
Larry, first of all, I'm not a weatherman. I'm a meteorologist. I'd appreciate a little bit of respect,
Larry.
Excuse me,
doctor.
Can you guys just calm down? We're in the middle of a game of golf here.
And so John, please, in Fawlty Towers, is an incompetent perfectionist. He wants perfection, but he can't achieve it because he's incompetent.
Yes.
And so his car breaks down. Another imperfection. Probably because he doesn't bother to, you know, get it serviced. And he talks to the car. And he says, I've warned you many times. And this is the end. This is it.
This is it. I'm going to give you a damn good thrashing.
And he rips a branch off a tree and beats the paint off the fenders of the car. So, we see he's crazy.
Definitely. Yeah. And as you point out, the relationships between characters play a huge part in the success of any creative fictional work. Can you talk a bit about how the character relationships contributed to the success of Vince Gilligan's Breaking Bad?
Well, it's an enormous cast to begin with. And the key is you design a cast like that based on the principle that you do not treat different people the same. And so when you create a cast full of different kinds of people in relationship to the central character, every time any two characters meet, they bring out qualities, distinctive qualities in each other. And so you have to design a cast that's designed to exploit and explore the dimensions in each other. You know, you don't want a character having the same relationship and the same behavior with two or three other people. And one of the most important qualities of relationship, maybe the most important, is power. And so when two people meet, and there's rarely a balance of power. One has more or less than the other. And as a result, their behaviors become whatever they become because of the difference in power.
I want there to be no confusion. I know I owe you my life. And more than that, I respect the strategy. In your position, I would have done the same.
And so you try to build a cast amongst other qualities of intimacy versus, you know, social relationships. But anyway, you try to build a cast with an eye to the power relationships, because they're one key at least to behavior.
Yes, most definitely. So speaking of characters, you had a chance to see yourself as a character when you were famously played by Brian Cox in the movie adaptation. What was that like, and how did that character work for you?
Well, you know, when they came to me, they had to have my approval for all this, of course.
Right.
And so I got a call from Ed Saxon, the producer, and he says, I've got a problem. I've got this writer. He's written a screenplay, and he's made you a character in it. He has freely stolen dialogue out of your mouth and your book, and we don't know what to do. And I said, well, send it to me, and I'll see what. So they sent it to me, and I could see what Charlie Kaufman was up to, and so I saw what he was up to. He wanted to use my character to represent Hollywood, as if Hollywood as some sort of oppressive force that eliminates creative choices in artists. I read the screenplay, of course, and I realized, well, this screenplay needs an antagonist, because otherwise it's just a story about a guy suffering writer's block, and who cares about that? And so he wanted me to be the antagonist and the force, the commercial force of Hollywood, which is false. But I thought, it's okay. I said, but A, I need my redeeming scene, and I need control of the casting. And so I said, I want you to send me a list of 10 actors that you're considering, and I will try to guide you toward who I think would be best. So, because I couldn't be sure, was this what their school of casting would be? Is this the, you know, Dan Aykroyd, Danny DeVito school of casting, or what? And so they sent me a list of the 10 greatest British middle-aged actors alive. And from Michael Caine to, you know, Terrence Stamp, everybody. And I said, I see what they're after, some sort of gruff professor type. But there was a name that was not on the list. And that was Brian Cox.
And God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing. Any idiot can write voiceover narration to explain the thoughts of a character. Okay, that's it. 1 hour for lunch.
all these other actors, you know, like Christopher Plummer, all of them are all wonderful. But in most actors, no matter who they're playing, good guy, bad guy, no matter who they're playing, there's always this subtext of love me, love me. You know, they're always, actors want to be loved.
Sure, right? Just like people.
And, yeah, of course, yeah. But I knew that Brian Cox, because I had seen Brian work in the West End of London, and I knew that Brian Cox would not do that love me subtext thing, because I do not want to be loved. I want to be respected,
yeah.
But I do not want people following me like some guru.
Right.
I went to see the screenings, one of the early screenings, with my son. And we came out, and I said, Paul, what'd you think? He said, Dad, he nailed you.
How did you react to that? Was that good or bad?
I thought that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
And it was, I realized that in my dealings, certainly when I'm lecturing, there's an intensity that most students have never experienced from somebody giving them a lecture.
Do you really hate the use of voiceover as much as Brian's interpretation of you does?
No, that's always been, I never said I was categorically against voiceover the way Charlie Kaufman wrote the dialogue to put in Brian Cox's mouth.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
What I've always said is that the substitution of voiceover storytelling for dramatization, that is really shallow.
Find an ending, but don't cheat. And don't you dare bring in a deus ex machina.
Whoops, we're out of time. How's that for deus ex machina? Robert McKee is the author of Character, The Art of Role and Cast Design for Page, Stage, and Screen. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Gene Hanf Korlitz, Maggie May, and Robert McKee. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes that make long drives and tedious housework more bearable, Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
If I stopped putting things off, I would be happier.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Why should I be made to feel I have to apologize for my existence?
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I need to read more, improve myself.